What did you want to do in nonverbal film?
Essentially, provide, rather than a story, an experience for people through the fusion of music and image, so that, in effect, the audience would have the opportunity to have an emotional base to evaluate ordinary daily living, rather than just be entertained through the mechanism of a story. I felt from the beginning that film offered a unique opportunity to offer, in effect, a transformational quality or an alchemic quality of transformation of consciousness if there was an experience rather than a story. So I felt that putting music in the place of dialogue would offer that opportunity, in effect, to be able to see the music and hear the image.
What's the concept that you started with?
The concept was the society of the spectacle, that we're surrounded, encased in our own environment, in God world, if you want, above the earth, where all activity is mediated through technological and industrial mechanisms, so that people in a progressive society, in societies of modernization and development, no longer have their own direct experience of life, but operate through mediation at all times. And I wanted to be able to show that this was the nature of ordinary daily living. I felt it more important that people be able to experience that than to define it, so that the object was not so much to lead the audience, but to provide a long view of this phenomena so that people could evaluate it for themselves, in effect, to raise questions rather than to answer them. The point of the production was to be provocative, if not iconoclastic.
Do you want to describe some of the juxtapositions you've created in the editing?
We look at the world as a place having its own being, its own consciousness, its own presence, and show that the industrial assumption or the modern assumption about the world is a place of raw material and resource. So we juxtapose that. We try to show, as a key to viewing the film, that an atomic explosion in the film is presented perhaps in what people would consider a beautiful way, and that's a key that we're looking to the beauty of the beast. We took as our inspiration for that the book of Revelation that talks about the beast coming as an alluring being, as something that is enticing, and in fact the word koianiskatsi most prominently means the ability to entice people out of their birthright, and we felt that's the nature of progress, and that koianiskatsi is the word that most aptly describes that.
Is it slightly contradictory to be using high technology special effects type shooting to show the sham of living in a world with technology?
It's probably highly contradictory rather than slightly. However, people learn in terms of what they already know, and I could not manifest this without using the instrumentality that people are accustomed to. So I felt that I was making a cultural kamikaze use of these instruments in order to short circuit. So it was a very prescribed use of instrumentality. That it is contradictory is unquestionable, but I felt that that's the nature of the situation that I was faced with, and I would gladly assume that position.
I think the film takes the approach that technology is really making life and the planet very bad. Yet on the other hand, I know that you and Philip Glass were flying from coast to coast 30 to 40 times in collaborating on the movie. Is that too contradictory with the statement that you're making in the movie?
Well, some people felt it was so contradictory that they wouldn't give money any longer for the film. I felt that, however, I had to accept this situation because this was the situation that we found ourselves in. I'll use an analogy to give an example. While I don't feel television is particularly useful for people because of the nature of its of the medium, so many lines per second, a radiation gun aimed at the being, my wishing that it not be so will not eliminate it. So I'm faced with the situation of an extraordinary utilization of the medium in order to question the medium, and that's why I feel it's a kamikaze use of that medium.
Well, part of what you're questioning is things like Manhattan traffic, people riding up and down elevators or escalators with bored looks on their faces, which is, I mean, it's not the most exciting experience in the world when you're riding up and down the elevator. But what options do people on their way to work have if they want to get up to the sixth floor?
To get up to the sixth floor is the question. And I guess what I'm questioning is that the centralization of life, the acceleration of life, the density of life, the standardization of life, all of these things that context, ordinary daily living, are things that we no longer see because they've become necessities of life. In effect, we're like junkies hooked on electromagnetic energy, steel, and the fast, accelerated pace of life. Information comes to us with high velocity, as does transportation, and these are the things that I wanted to question. I felt that the question is the mother of the answer, and if we could be provocative through this fusion of sound and image that creates the experience of that question, that we would offer people something different.
To show the high-speed nature of living, you sped up the footage that was shot. It looked to me like maybe 10 times or...
Well, when you... at speed is considered 24 frames a second. You can take that in intervals of half. So we go from 24 to 12 to 6 to 3.5 to 1.5 to 3 to 1.5 and on the other side of 0. Or you could take it on the upside all the way up, in this case, to 800 frames a second. So what we achieved were images of documentary quality, but by the manipulation of camera speeds, allowing us to see the ordinary from an extraordinary point of view. In technical terms, that would be called in-camera animation.
Why did you want to speed up things to such a high-paced pitch that it truly looks absurd? Because, and then criticize it for looking too fast.
Well, because I think we are already absurd and can't view it because it looks so ordinary, and this is a thing that we have to do. It's merely a technique to show actually what's actually happening. People who do urban planning and study cities do it in precisely the same manner at high speed or time lapse so that they can get a real sense for the rhythm or the physics of the velocity that they're dealing with, because while the human eye can't perceive it, it's actually moving at that speed. It was also, in a poetic sense, trying to show as if an alien had arrived here and perceiving the nature of high-speed velocity in ordinary daily living.
You asked Philip Glass to do the score for the movie. What did you find compatible about Glass's music?
I wanted music that would have a trance capacity. By trance, I mean having the potential to open the conscious mind to another point of view. And while I knew his music was not based in the Western scales of music, but based in Eastern scales, in Indian scales, specifically Vedic Hindu chant, I felt that rhythm structures were very possible to open the mind for that kind of perception. I felt Glass was the master of that kind of instrumentation, that kind of notation in our country, so he was an appropriate choice.
Was he initially interested?
No. He had had one bad experience with a film. He never wanted to do a film again. I had a most difficult time getting him to a screening, though he was polite about refusing. I worked through a friend that we both mutually share. He had Philip come to a screening. I made 3 demo reels using already pre-recorded music of Philip from another time. And he said, well, this is film as metaphor. I would be using music as co-equal with image. And he wanted to sign on, so I was very happy for that.
What was your working relationship like during the movie?
Intense and very rewarding. I find Philip to be able to produce composition at a rapid pace on an inspired level. He was not a person who was a prima donna. He was willing to hear all of my ideas as well as the people that I was working with, so it made for very fruitful cooperation. He was also energetic and full of interest, so it made it very wonderful to work with him.
My guest is Godfrey Reggio, if you're just joining us, the director and producer of the film Kyanaskatsi, which opens at the TLA on South Street on January 27th. I understand that before you started getting involved with movies, and this is your first movie and a second movie is in the works now, that you were a monk.
Yes.
For a while. What order were you in?
I was in the Christian Brothers, which is a Roman Catholic pontifical order. I went in at the age of 14 and stayed till 28, and through mutual agreement after final vows, I obtained a papal dispensation to leave the order. I felt that I could no longer pursue what was my own feeling about what the work I should be doing should be, and felt that I could best do that out of the confines of the religious order.
When you were 14 and became a part of it, was it something you wanted to do, or did you just not have any other options for your
life
at that
time? No, I very much wanted to do it. I grew up in New Orleans in a very stratified racist society and, frankly, was going crazy with the contradictions involved in that kind of social structure, and found an idealism which was appealing to my adolescent emotion and mind, and went for it at 14.
Are there any philosophical influences from that experience or from perhaps other reading that you've done that feeds into Koyaanisqatsi?
Yes.
Koyaanisqatsi?
I think all of us are on a timeline in terms of our, you know, our time and space in this life, and one thing influences the other. From the age of 14 to 19, I got to live essentially in the Middle Ages with French monks who were at least suspect of the world and its values, and I'm sure that influenced my thinking, more particularly as I began as a young monk to study philosophy and theology. I was very impacted by the teachings of Giovanni Roncalli, who is John the 23rd, through his works Pacimenteris, Matei Magistra. I was very encouraged. His basic admonition to all of us was to accept nothing, question everything, and that fit into my own personal philosophy of life. After that, I guess I was most influenced by the works of a French philosopher, Jacques Ellul, who 26 years ago wrote the book The Technological Society. He's had another 26 books since then, and Leopold Kohr, the Viennese philosopher who informed the likes of E.F. Schumacher, Small is Beautiful, and then most specifically with a friendship with Ivan Illich, who has been a gadfly in a sense, working with people to question the nature of industrial technology.
When did the Hopi words and prophecies come into play with the movie? Had you known about that before beginning work on Koyaanisqatsi?
I'd only known about it from a distance. The film started in July of 75. In the middle of 76, I had the opportunity to go to the Hopi mesas in Arizona to meet with traditional Hopi elders in the village of Hotvilla, and became, I guess, very curious about their cosmology of the world and the universe, that essentially everything that we called normal or regular, they considered abnormal, and I felt a great camaraderie with that mentality, a point of view, because that's what motivated me to begin the film, Koyaanisqatsi. I initially did not want a title for the film because I felt I could develop an ideogram or an image that would provide the equivalent of a title, but that became not so feasible when trying to promote the film. So as the film was winding down to completion in the last year, I was faced with the necessity of having a title, and I looked in the English language and several European languages, could not find the word I wanted, and went back to those people I thought shared my point of view, and I found after 9 months of research with Hopis and some scholars who were studying Hopi, the word Koyaanisqatsi, which essentially means life out of balance, life disintegrating, crazy life, and the state of life that calls for another way of living. I felt encouraged by the power of the word. I knew from friends that it was not a very commercial title because most people couldn't pronounce it or it looked Russian or Japanese, but I felt that the word itself had innate power and that it would be an apt title for the phenomena that I was trying to describe.
There are several prophecies that flash on the screen at the end of the movie for viewers to read. And their prophecies, well, why don't you describe what those prophecies are and then maybe tell us how you see them fitting in.
Well, let me first say that the Hopis have a prophecy for virtually everything. And to know all the prophecies, you would literally have to know all the Hopis. The Hopis are an anarchistic assemblage of villages, and no one person knows all of the prophecies. In fact, some people aspire to clue into other people's dreams so that they can absorb all of those. I went through many, many prophecies and ended up with three. They are, if we dig precious things from the ground, we will invite disaster. I thought that worked in well with my understanding that the industrial society views the earth not as a place of balance and harmony, but a place of raw material and resource to be consumed to create God world or the synthetic world that we live in. To create a media world. Another prophecy was, during the day of purification, there'll be cobwebs spun back and forth in the sky. And for those of us that live in the Southwest as I do, there are jet highway paths all in the skies that are very manifest and visible. So I thought that would be an obvious sign that we were at this point of imbalance and calling for a time of purification. And the third prophecy I chose is that perhaps one day They will drop a gourd of ashes from the sky that will boil the oceans and burn the earth. And that prophecy was manifested in 1946, I think, immediately after the, or shortly after the first explosion at the Valley of Death in New Mexico of the atomic bomb. That particular prophecy was important because it was at that point when that sign appeared that the Hopis were told to manifest their prophecies to the outside world. Most people feel prophecies are a bit hocus-pocus because they don't fit into our techno-fantasies, but in effect, I felt those mythic structures offered us a way to view from another point of view our notions about progress and development.
I understand that before you were making movies that you did some public service commercials, was it?
Well, I had worked with the foundation that I'm part of and the National Office of the American Civil Liberties Union to do a campaign on police surveillance, behavioral modification, the use of drugs to control behavior, essentially the use of technology as a method of controlling people's ideas and behavior. We did that in 1974, 10 years before 1984, so that we could prefigure what we said was 1984 was 10 years ahead of schedule. Rather than have PSAs or public service announcements, which get no real viewing or listening audience because they're early in the morning or late at night to meet station requirements for FCC, we did a campaign that bought primetime spots. We were running 4 spots a night per network affiliate. We were running radio spots in drive time. We did billboards at high traffic density areas. We wrote a book and inserted it as a Sunday supplement to the state's largest newspaper. And what we found by buying that time was that we took public opinion from 14% to 51% in 4 weeks and influenced national legislation to eliminate lobotomies or psychosurgery in all federal institutions. We eliminated in the state that the campaign was done the use of Social Security number as a universal identifier for children. And essentially, it indicated to me that if we could make an alternative use of a medium that was used to lull people, that we could actually connect with a mass audience and develop a constituency around issues that were to everyone's interest.
Can you describe one of the spots that you did?
The first spot we did was an eye. Every time the eye blinked, there was a camera click. That was it. We deliberately made the tagline so illegible that most people couldn't read it because we didn't want that to be in the way. It had FCC says you have to give credit to whatever is on the tube, but it was very small, so you couldn't read it. What we did also was take the pyramid on the back of the dollar with the shibboleth e pluribus unum in many one and go inside the pyramid to see the electronic nature of it, launch the eye into outer space through animation and had it do surveillance, which of course satellites are doing constantly over probably every square mile of the planet. Another one, we had children playing Red Rover in the park. Every time they would break hands in that game, there would be a mugshot of children with Social Security numbers around their neck. We actually used Gordon Liddy's number that was once on television, for which we had a huge response from the federal government. And we had a rat in a maze intercut with a freeway scene in Los Angeles. Those kinds of ads that were provocative, nonverbal in structure, and we had actually a phenomena in the market that these were aired in. People were calling in to find out when the next TV ads would be on rather than when the next programs would be on.
What were you able to take away from that experience into your filmmaking?
That if you could provide an experience through the medium that would connect with people's interests, that you would in effect be able to offer them something different than what they were getting over conventional mediums. I feel if we can use conventional mediums, since we're tied into them and they're omnipresent in terms of their impact on society, that we could use those mediums to short-circuit the monocultural values that everyone accepts without question.
What kind of responses have you gotten from viewers to your movies? I don't mean them saying whether they liked it or not, but
right.
I mean how it's affected them, if it's had a deep effect on them.
Well, that's hard to say because I don't go to most of the screenings. My job is over with, really, having made the film. The few screenings I've been to, and frankly, the letters I do get, indicate that many people have been inspired by the movie rather than entertained, that it reached to a deeper spot than to what entertainment reached. And I feel, of course, very, very gratified by that. That was the intention to begin with.
I guess what I'm asking is with the spots that you were just talking about.
Oh, with the TV spots.
With the TV spots, there was specific behavior that you wanted, like to influence legislation.
Yes.
Or to change a program.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. There's nothing that specific that you're looking for to change in this. What you want to change is like perspective in general.
Right.
But have you gotten any feedback that people are making any changes in their individual lives or seeing things in a specifically different way?
Yes, I do. I get letters now, I guess, every day. People saying that it's encouraged them to pursue filmmaking from another point of view, or it encouraged them to at least believe the fantasies that they had been entertaining about how crazy the world is. I've been invited by many film schools for lectures in terms of other methods of approaching film rather than industrial methods. So I think it's having an effect. While we were not, the intention of Koyaanisqatsi is not to motivate a specific behavior. It's more to influence people's perceptions on the world they live in, and more appropriately to raise questions about that. And I think the film has done that. It's a disturbing film.
My guest is Godfrey Reggio, the director and producer of the film Koyaanisqatsi, which opens at the TLA on South Street on January 27th. There's a lot of special effects shooting in it, in addition to sped up and slowed down. Photography, there's also, I'll have to ask you what it is, but there's also like ways of shooting clouds and, it's the clouds specifically that I'm thinking of now,
right,
that gets an effect that I think I've seen in some narrative films as well. I think it might have even been the same photographer doing it. But perhaps you can describe what the effect is and how it's achieved.
Actually, those are all in-camera animation techniques, and they do deal with motor speeds. At speed is 24 frames. To have clouds looking like cascading waves in the water, you actually slow down the camera, which speeds up the image. So we were shooting those clouds at a frame and a half a second. We being, in this case, Louis Schwartzberg of Energy Productions in Los Angeles, who spent 10 years filming cloud formations in Haleakala. And we actually have one shot in the film that took 9 months to achieve. It was a fixed camera from the Hollywood Hills looking into downtown Los Angeles with a long lens. It was a pollution study. So with patience and the ability to manipulate the camera speeds, we were able to get extraordinary images of ordinary things. We also used techniques of running the negative back and forth through the camera many times to produce ghost-like images, such as we have in the stock exchange. We also had a shot of a moon, an extremely large moon, coming up on an office building. We shot that, again, by moving the negative through the camera twice, but using different lenses and masking off part of the lens each time. So everything we did were techniques that were essentially simple, that didn't require a lot of money, but required a lot of calculation and patience.
How has the film and the comments that you make in it changed you?
Well, it's offered me an opportunity to do another film.
Mm-hmm.
It's encouraged me to believe that I was on the right direction, that I could influence people's perceptions if I could put an unconventional product now in a conventional medium.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that is, I guess, encouraged me to continue on this path, as the ACLU project encouraged me to do Koyaanisqatsi.
The public service spots that you were talking about, the really highly produced ones, were in a way about manipulation and how, like with that eye,
yes,
that you were describing, how we should avoid it and seek legislation that will protect us against that kind,
yes,
of manipulation.
Uh-huh.
Is your film, in a way, a very manipulative film, though? I mean, aren't you
well, film
using media to manipulate people's
film
emotions.
In itself is manipulative because you're not dealing with discrete shots in themselves. You have to make a decision shot for shot how to edit it. So the medium itself is manipulated. However, that term is loaded because it means that you perhaps, or it can mean to many people that you have a malevolent intention for manipulation. I would say rather it's the task of filmmaking to construct these images in such a fashion that they achieve your point of view. But the nature of filmmaking is manipulating image. If you've ever edited film and you know that you have to put literally thousands of hours on a table manipulating shot for shot, speed for speed. When you do an orchestration, you have to manipulate notes. So in that sense, it's based on manipulation. If manipulation means there's an ulterior motive that people don't understand that is going to work against their good or be subversive, then I guess I would have to reject that as the form of manipulation that we used.
I think in a way that you're making very categorical statements in the film that nature is good or is at least real and the way things were intended to be, and that technology, urban life, skyscrapers, rush, hurry, chaos are unnatural and life out of balance.
Correct.
You have found for yourself within the modern Western world at least a niche that you feel very positive about. And I'm thinking of film and of jetting back and forth from coast to coast and jetting around the world using high technology to make your movies for a point that you really believe in. Why didn't you include something in the film about technology that's fun or creative or useful, what I think you might have done, which is just categorically condemn it?
Well, I didn't categorically condemn it. What I tried to do was categorically raise questions about it. I tried to play the role of the iconoclast. Again, your question comes up, is it immoral? I'll try to abstract from what you said. Is it immoral to use things that you criticize? I don't feel it's immoral to do that. I feel that I'm making the only use available to me at the time. I don't have any other, if I could have an immaculate conception of the idea, then I would perhaps try to do that, but that would be presumptuous. My body is paying the price for this acceleration. My nerves are paying the price for it, but I'm willing to do that because of my objective. And unfortunately, this is the world we live in. I think people do the right thing for the wrong reason, and we're all caught in that syndrome. I don't live in a unindustrialized, technological environment. I live in a highly sophisticated technological environment, and I'm trying to have an impact on that in the best way I know how.
I guess it wasn't really so much a moral question I was asking, but rather, I bet you really love film. I mean, most filmmakers.
Well, I really,
really
don't.
Do.
If you want to know, I have no background in it. I've seen very few films. I made a very pragmatic choice of media because I myself operate no equipment. I don't operate computers. I don't operate cameras. I work with people who are fanatics and who love to do that, who, by the way, do not share my perspective about the world. But I feel like a blind man who has to work through other people's instruments. So it's not something that I personally enjoy in terms of the actual hands-on technology. It's something that I've made a very pragmatic choice of.
So you don't really love film?
No.
And music?
Music I love, yes. But I don't really love the process that goes into making film. I'd rather actually shovel dung and bury the dead than deal with the technology. It's not something that I find interesting or appealing. It's something that I made a deliberate choice to use because that's the trough or the medium that people are trapped in. I'll give you an example. Billboards. People can't avoid billboards in this society because they're omnipresent. People can't avoid the tube because they're addicted to it. People use film because it's the only cultural medium that gives them a release. I would put music in a different category from that because it tends to deal with instrumentation and the personal expression of a spirit through that instrument. But high tech is where we are, and that's the medium I felt most appropriate to connect with people on.
So what you're really about in the work you're doing is communicating the message.
Yes.
Do you think of yourself as a prophet or a guru
no,
in terms
no,
of that?
No. Uh-huh. I don't. I consider myself a person who wants to make a creative use of my imagination. I feel, I guess, committed, like with the commitment to an insane asylum, to this world, and I'm trying, like many other people, to bust out and to raise questions about these things that we never question at all.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. Appreciate being here.